Hello again, and welcome, crew and passengers alike, to the newsletter from GaiaSpora.org, offering Gnostic intel and Sophianic insight on events and issues of today. This is issue number 7, presented by your friendly, homegrown Telestis John Lash. The title is The New Look of Nous. And the day of release of this issue is December 21st, 2014, the date of the winter solstice. In this issue, I am announcing, the phasing out of the newsletter and the description of what is to replace it. I won't take a lot of time to explain my reasons for this decision. It's simply due to the way I've felt about the material I presented so far, and also the way I felt about how it was being received. To be honest, I sensed that my delivery was kind of flat, and as far as I can tell, you know, I'm a pretty sensitive animal, as you may have gathered. As far as I can tell about what you're picking up out there, that there may have been a kind of lapse or drop in the tension of the attention circuits. And I'm extremely sensitive to this because I do speak to your attention circuits. So I pondered for a few days and discussed the problem with my intrepid assistant, Mario. And I came to the conclusion that my initial notion was flawed. What was my initial notion? You may recall that I mentioned that I would dedicate some talks and writing to teaching what I already know rather than teaching what I'm in the process of learning. Well, I can certainly do that. There are a number of subjects that I know pretty well. Romanticism, the Romantic movement, Romantic literature, the Russian Romantic movement, modernism, which is an outgrowth of the Romantic movement. Those are subjects I know pretty well. And I could discourse and expound on those subjects for years at length. I'm sure that if I was a professor employed in some small avant-garde college somewhere in the United States, if such institutions still exist, well, I could perform pretty well in that setting. But that's not the setting of the world today, is it? Nor is it the setup for the applications of Gnostic intel to the situation in the world. So in a nutshell, what I'm saying is, I'm getting back to teaching about what I'm learning, and I'm doing a sight more than that as well. As I explained in the written part of this newsletter, the series will continue to issue 9. That makes a total of 10 issues, and you can consider it sort of like the limited edition of a special journal or a magazine. After I discontinue the newsletter in January, I will continue in the same manner and intent with a different series. Let's call it Nous Flashes. And these Nous Flashes will not go out consistently on the 5th and 21st of every month, but they will go out whenever the flash occurs. So when Lass has a flash, then these messages will come out from GaiaSpora.org, and that is the sequence of material that I would like to provide and present with the phasing out of the newsletter. Now, as I indicate here, there are going to be 3 more issues of the newsletter. Well, this one and 2 more, and L8 will be dedicated to the completion of my treatment of romantic individuality, bringing it more into focus of the current time. And In NL9, I'll concentrate on Islam and the phenomenon of Islam in the world at large, and also in the Nation of Islam, which is a vast movement in the USSA, the United Soviet States of America. Or you could as well say the United Socialist States of America. That is certainly what some people would like to see the good old USA become, and sooner rather than later. And I suspect that to a great extent, due to the left and the liberals and the Jewish agenda behind the left and the machinations of cultural Marxism and so forth and so on, I suspect that the United States of America is well on the way to being turned into a socialist nightmare. But like anything else that happens in human terms, in human society, it can all be turned around by the power of human courage, intelligence, integrity, love, and the warrior spirit. Now, bear in mind that as of December this year, which is this month, I am delivering through 8 platforms on the internet. I explained this setup in my message of September 15th, but the picture has changed in some details since then. And so you see here listed by number what those platforms are, namely midhistory.org with the subsite of Planetary Tantra, KaliRising.org, Gaiaspora.org, Celestics.org. The KWP has been online since December 10th. It has its own website, .org. A YouTube channel for the Calico War Party, which is parked and waiting, like a Maserati at the curve. A YouTube channel for John Lamb Lash, which is parked and waiting, like a Bugatti in the forecourt. And finally, last but not least, I have what you might call a professional site, johnlamlash.org, which is more or less a link platform extending into various aspects of my teaching events, and which has a little biographical content. So note also that in the future, I will not announce Calico War Party related material, talks, and texts on the mailing list in which you have received this message. You can sign up on the Calico War Party site if you want to stay current specifically with that event, and there is a different mailing list involved. Thanks again to each and all for your support and your donations. I've never been in a situation like this in my entire life, and it's a good moment to be in this situation. You're making it easier for me to do what I do. I can assure you that your contributions all make a difference in concrete terms, and they provide, you know, comfort and necessities that I would not otherwise enjoy. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the topic of AI pestilence. Pestilence, a plague, a pestilence, and AI meaning, of course, archontic infection. In the concluding newsletter, I will cover Islam in some detail, and I strongly propose that you do some homework in advance. Now, as far as I know, the best source on this topic, the outstandingly good source, is Bill Warner, who has a site called politicalislam.com. Now, some of his talks I may have already referenced to you. Why We Are Afraid to Know About Islam. This is a tremendous talk which absolutely shifted my perspective on history about 6 or 7 degrees. This is a paradigm-changing, mindset-demolishing talk, and really of incomparable value among the material that I have researched on the problematical subject of Islam. Also, you'll really have to fasten your seatbelt for this one, A Taste of Islam. In this talk, which is less than a half an hour, I think, Bill Warner, who is always succinct and lucid in his presentations, explains some essential things about Islam. And one of those things is the fact that the bedrock of Islam is not merely the Quran, but it is also the biography of Muhammad, which I think runs to about 800 pages, and the Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H, which are the commentaries on the Quran. So the true foundation of Islam is this threefold structure, these three books. And Bill Warner describes what is in these books. And he also describes the important fact, which I have heard no one else explain, that the Quran consists of two parts. The earlier part written in Mecca during 13 years when Muhammad acquired no more than 100 or so followers, and the second part written in Medina when he declared jihad and ended up acquiring by the end of his life more than well over 100,000 fanatical supporters. Did you know that? And one thing that Bill Warner does, another thing that he does in a brilliant fashion, is to explain the schizophrenic mindset of Islam. You know, when you hear the word Islam, you think of Muslims, you think of two things, or I always think of two things. One is this soft, genial, kind, hospitable Middle Eastern face. You know, the elegant and generous host, the Muslim, who is the elegant and generous host to the non-Muslim, and who says that Islam is a religion of peace and quotes lines from the first Quran, the Quran of Mecca, which more or less would convince you, taken by themselves, that Islam is peaceful. But alongside of that, simultaneously, comes up the image of the terrorist who beheads people, the jihadist, and so forth, jihadi, I guess it's called. And Bill Warner explains that the Muslim lives in a permanent state of schizophrenia in which both of these factors are true. Islam is not one or the other, it is both of these. But then you ask, well, how can it be both of those if they are so contradictory? And the answer to that is that the peculiar manifestation of the archontic infection in the mind of Muslims allows them to hold two contradictory, violently, dramatically contradictory viewpoints without contradiction. This is terrifying to consider. I hope I got that right about the Mecca part of the Quran and the Medina part. And I didn't get it backwards. Anyway, you'll get it in Bill's talk on A Taste of Islam and his other talks, shorter talks, which are right to the point concerning the terrifying insanity of Islamic religion. And at the end of the day, you may agree, as I do, with Bill Warner's conclusion, which is that Islam is not a religion, actually. It is a political system of totalitarian control, suppression, and repression. It is the agenda for a perfect theocracy, which is to say, a perfect archontic social order. And this is terrifying. And this is happening all around the world. Happening in Tennessee, according to one of Bill Warner's talks. So anyway, I'll talk more about that in NL9. And just for the kick of it, I include an opposing view, which is a long talk with a 6-minute ass-kissing introduction by Karen Armstrong. Here you see an example of an apologist for Islam who lies a blue streak about the actual actions and events of Muhammad's life and the doctrine. And she totally misrepresents Islam. And you have to wonder, I have to wonder how it is possible for a human mind to be so corrupted that it lies pathologically without realizing it is doing so. I'm sure this woman doesn't realize that she is lying. Now, you might not be able to listen to the entire lecture. I certainly couldn't stomach it, but you might want to skip through and pick up certain points in her treatment of Islam and in her presentation of Muhammad as a prophetic pacifist who needs to be recognized as an important figure in our time. I mean, it's truly deplorable, gut-wrenching disinformation. Now, on that subject and on the example of Karen Armstrong, by the way, I encountered Karen Armstrong probably 10 or 15 years ago as I was doing the background research for Not in His Image, because she's known as a writer on religious topics. And I remember at that time, even way back then, she wrote some book about God. And it had a chapter of on Islam in it, I think. And I was just so angry and so outraged and disgusted by her book. I rarely throw books away. I think in my life I have thrown away no more than 5 books, certainly. Just thrown them away. I threw this book about God away that Karen Armstrong had written. So now she's on the bandwagon, she's on the soapbox promoting Islam, and it is truly, truly gruesome to watch. But while I'm on this subject, before I get to the more positive side of this newsletter, I'd like to point out something that you may have already noticed. And in doing so, I'd like to update you on my current talk circuit on the internet. You may have noticed that in the interview with Red Ice at the beginning of August, around the anniversary of the term of Gaia Awakening, I introduced the topic of the archontic infection with a new spin. Up until that point, over a number of years now, as you well know, I've been talking about the archontic program of religion, of salvationism, as a foreign installation in the human mind. Foreign installation being, of course, a phrase borrowed from Castaneda, who said that the flyers, who are identical with the archons, install a foreign installation in the human mind. Well, the treatment of that subject in Not in His Image and many other writings and talks, confined itself to a kind of metaphor. That is to say, I used the metaphor of a virus, and I said that salvationist religion was an ideological virus. I also pointed out that with the rise in influence of the Tzaddikim, the Qumran Dead Sea sect, in the early Christian centuries, a number of observers of the time who were pagan intellectuals also used the term plague to describe the ideology of Tzaddikite salvationist religion. So this has a good precedent here, doesn't it? Well, and you don't find the metaphor or trope of the plague specifically used in the surviving Gnostic materials, as far as I know. But it is certainly there in that era and can be found in certain texts written by, as I say, pagan intellectuals. Can also be found in the New Testament, where Saul of Tarsus is said to have been regarded as a plague carrier by some of the people of his time. Okay, what I did in the Red Ice interview was to go a step further. And I stated, on the basis of raw Gnostic intel gathered today, that there was a neural hack into the human brain. The Archons actually achieved a neural hack, and they deposited a virus. And so it is not just a metaphor. It is literally true. Now, you may have noticed that I made that announcement. I leaked the news about AI, the Archonic infection. But I did not go into detail in profiling it, and I did not describe how the Archons achieved this particular feat of intervention, certainly one of their greatest triumphs. So it remains for me to do that, and I expect to do that in some of my upcoming interviews over the next couple of months. The follow-up interview with Red Eyes was recorded on the 20th of December and will be posted on the 26th. That follow-up interview, however, does not really follow up on the subject of the Archontic infection as such. It goes directly to the subject of the Calico War Party. So I need to follow up the Gnostic intel on AI in some interview somewhere along the way, don't I? So you can anticipate that, and I will certainly announce that interview through this mailing list at the appropriate moment. Now, keeping Karen Armstrong in mind, I'd like to give you a little preview of the profile that I am going to present, the full-blown profile of the Archontic infection. What I will explain is that there are two stages of the Archontic infection that happened in historical times within the reach of historical memory. And these two stages of the infection, called stage one and stage two infection, can be compared to the infection of certain viruses today, wherein the virus becomes more virulent in its second stage because it has grown strong against any attempts to resist it. So you've all heard the story of viruses that are now plaguing hospitals, superviruses, superbugs, that resist any kind of antibiotic. The Archontic infection behaves somewhat in this manner. Remember, the Archons can't create anything on their own, and so they would simply mimic processes of nature in the creation of this infection, which is a mucus deposit in the human brain. Now, let me give you the profile. I'm just going to leap over it very quickly, of the historical and neurochemical activity of this virus. Stage 1, archonic infection, occurred among a small faction of people known as the ancient Hebrews, and then spread widely among the Hebrews of the Middle East because of the close inbreeding of that particular tribe of people. So, and because of other practices that they had, and they still have to this day, such as circumcision and sucking the blood of the child's penis. Now, stage 1 infection means direct transmission of the virus, of the mucus, into the human brain. Delivery of the mucus into the human brain. And there it found its way into the auditory cortex. Now, the auditory cortex is bilateral. It's located on both sides of the human brain, on the sides of the head. It's my guess at this point, it's an inspired and informed guess, based on intel that I'm still gathering, that the stage 1 infection only reached one side of the brain. And it was designed in such a way that the mucus that spread in the brain and masked itself behind the neurochemical operations of L-DOPA literally took over the brain and rewired it. In this sense, the archonic infection is similar to toxoplasmosis, as I've explained. But in another sense, the archonic infection is also similar to Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Now, there is such a thing as proxy behavior, that is to say, mimetic or imitative behavior. You may not have a particular disease, such as Munchausen syndrome, a particular psychological or behavioral condition. Go look it up. You may not actually have that condition, but you can have Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which is to say, in some mysterious and enigmatic manner, which science has not explained, but which nevertheless is demonstrated in this bizarre behavior, you imitate mimetically, you reproduce mimetically the behavior of someone who has a condition which you actually don't have. I mean, how bizarre is that? So, this is how it plays out historically. There was first the stage 1 infection, a neural hack into the human brain. That was the Zadokite sect of the ancient Hebrews. Then, there arose from that a massive behavioral response, a massive behavioral follow-up, you could say, in which there was a proxy manifestation of the initial neurological infection. In other words, people who did not have the neurological infection of the Zadokite Jews, which eventually has spread to the entire Jewish community, nevertheless behaved as if they did have it. So they had the archontic infection stage 1 by proxy. And who were those people? They were the Christians. And it is most significant that the transitional figure between the infection as a neurological condition and the infection by proxy was a Jew named Saul of Tarsus. Now, it's quite likely that because he was a Jew, he had the stage 1 neurological infection. He then, in turn, infected or introduced that infection in its proxy form into the society of the time, and the result of that is what you call Christianity. So we cruise along for a few centuries, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, let's go up to the 8th century, 7th or 8th century, and what has happened is The proxy manifestation of the stage one infection develops in Christianity. But the initial neurological infection due to the hack kind of starts to die out. Then, however, as happens with these kinds of viruses and epidemiological entities, the archonic infection proceeded to reboot itself. The rebooting is evident in what you call Islam. So, the Semitic Arabic peoples of Saudi Arabia were in a position historically, and this is all historical and concrete, they were in a position, for some reason or other, which I have not fully understood, this is a complex way that this AI works, they became the vehicles for the rebooting of a more virulent form, and that is stage two archonic infection. Now, something really complicated happened, which I have not yet been able to investigate, but I intend to do so soon, and this was the skipping of the archonic infection in its stage two out of the Semitic peoples, out of the vector of the Semitic peoples, toward Central and Eastern, toward Western Asiatic and Eastern European peoples. So it's significant, and I don't know if anyone has ever pointed this out. I am amazed at this coincidence. The so-called Khazar Empire and the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism happened at the same time as the rise of Islam in Saudi Arabia, didn't it? That is really an interesting historical coincidence. And I put it to you that that coincidence can be added to the table as evidence in the dossier of the prosecution of how the archonic virus works. The archonic virus skipped, it rebooted in its original ethnic vector, and then it skipped, and the rebooted form appeared in another ethnic vector, which is the Ashkenazi or Khazar Jewish lineage. And these Khazars, these Ashkenazi, are actually Asiatic Turks. They are descendants of Asiatic Turks. They are not Semitic. And yet they inherited, in some mysterious way, the mission of the Semitic people. No one has ever been able to sufficiently explain this, but I'll tell you the explanation will come ultimately soon. The explanation is here, and you see it, shockingly, you see it lucidly, when you put it in the framework of an epidemiological event. The history of the nightmare on this planet, of the nightmare of the Zadokites, the Christians, and the Muslims, who have brought more murder upon this planet than you can ever calculate, that history is best understood as an epidemiological phenomenon, and I intend to back that statement up and prove it to be so and to provide the evidence. I'm in the process of gathering the evidence to make a clear and convincing case. So you have stage two neural infection with the rise of Islam and the rise of the Khazars, who are converted to Judaism, which is the behavior of the first stage infection vector group. Got the picture? Now, I suspect, I can't absolutely verify this, because as I say, I'm dedicating myself with the time that I now have on my hands, thanks to the work I've done since August, along with the assistance I've received, which has been exceptional and spectacular, I'm dedicating the time that I have now, on my own, in retreat, you know where, to verify the details of this development. And I can only guess now, but my guess goes like this. When the AI rebooted in the 7th, 8th century, manifesting in the Khazar phenomenon and the rise of jihadic Islam at the same time, the infection spread to two temporal lobes, to both the temporal lobes. You know, it's my opinion. You can just say, well, John, this is pretty wild stuff, so it's only your opinion, you know, it's only your idea. Maybe it's a fantasy that you have. You've got a pretty powerful imagination there, old boy. But if you want to consider it to just be an opinion that I have that's groundless, go ahead. But I can tell you it's not groundless. And let me give you an example. I have a book here that I've pulled out of the Ambergane archives. I bought this book in Oslo which is also the place where I learned and discovered the story of Sabina Spielrein. She was the Jewish-Russian woman who was the first mistress of C.G. Jung. And she is the main character of my screenplay, Sabina. I discovered the Sabina story in Konlungen, which is near Oslo, a peninsula in the Oslo fjord. And in a bookstore in Oslo, I found this book, Sigmund Freud and the Jewish Mystical Tradition. This book gives the evidence that Sigmund Freud had in his library certain books of the Talmud and the Kabbalah, and that he seriously studied these Jewish works. And he brought them to London with him when he fled from the continent at the very end of his life. The author of this book, David Bakan, also gives an account of a certain belief system that belongs to Judaism, wherein Jews are taught that there are two angels that advise human beings. They speak in the voice of your mind, in that inner silence. They are the voices that you hear telling you, do this, don't do this, advising you. And it appears that in the Jewish tradition, it is common to teach people that one of these voices is like a good angel and the other is like a bad angel, and they sit on your two shoulders. And when you listen to the good angel, then you do what is right. It's my view that this particular concept, this picture, represents the status of the Jewish mind in which the archontic infection has taken over one side of the auditory complex, thereby creating an imbalance, thereby creating a situation where Jews themselves have an experience that gives rise to this description. Do you see what I mean? So with stage one neural infection, the neurochemical mucus, or cerebral mucus, if you want to call it that, that invades and reprograms the auditory complex, the auditory cortex, does not do so bilaterally, but only on one side. Now come ahead to the stage two neural infection, not by proxy, but the rebooting of the original infection. Well, how does that operate? Well, consider what I said a little earlier about what Bill Warner says about the particular characteristic of the doctrine of Islam, that the Muslim who follows this doctrine can hold two completely contradictory and conflicting notions at the same time, and they are both true for the person who holds them. I maintain that this fact, which is a fact of Muslim belief and Muslim behavior, may indicate that in the rebooting, the archontic infection spread to the other side of the brain And in stage two, it occupies or infects both the right and left temporal cortexes. Now, we're talking about an epidemiological view of history. We identify the rebooting of the virus in a complex manner in the 7th and 8th century. It's also the time when something very significant happened in Tibetan Buddhism, by the way, which is also an expression of archonic intrusion, but that's another story. Now we come ahead. 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries come up for 7 centuries, and we see how those who are infected with a stage 2 neural infection, that is to say, the first Muslims, are absolutely wreaking death and destruction all across Europe. Bill Warner explains, that they actively destroyed classical European culture, and he gives the proof of it. So they're on the rampage until around the 14th or 15th century, and then they are driven out of Spain by Guzman el Bueno, as I've described, the Spanish hero who died in the nearby white village. And then, once again, the virus is, in a way, running down. The Muslim power in society gets very, very, very weak, although they continue to commit genocides, most notably the late genocide of the Armenian peoples in the beginning of the 20th century, 1915, 1917. Where do we see and how do we detect the proxy expression of the stage 2 infection? Well, that would be what we call communism, Bolshevik communism. Now, it is true that the masterminds of the communist Bolshevik revolution, who were funded by Jewish bankers such as Schiff and Warburg and others, were Jews who had the first stage infection. But at the same time, how is it possible that a small number of these murderous Bolshevik ideologues, some 200 or so, who were funded and directed by the Jewish banking cabal, how is it that this small number could cause the genocide that occurred in Russia when the Bolsheviks hijacked the Russian Revolution? Well, that is an example of the proxy behavior of the stage 2 infection. And it didn't stop with the Bolsheviks of the Russian Revolution, because after the Russian Revolution was over, in the mid-60s, the same proxy behavior sprang up, who knows, guess where? Where did Bolshevik, Marxist Bolshevik revolutionary genocide spring up later in the 1960s? China. So, Mao Zedong, who was, by the way, closely handled and advised by Jews who had the first stage infection, which had been reinforced by the rebooting of the second stage infection, you get the picture, Mao Zedong was enacting by proxy the archontic infection in its second stage. It's not necessary that Mao Zedong or any of the Chinese people in his cadres had the neurological infection. They were demonstrating stage 2 AI by proxy. So you can see that will just bring you up to the current moment. Now, in the current moment, we're looking at stage 3 AI, and that won't even need a proxy manifestation, because that is the complete wipeout of the human brain, a wipeout so profound that it cannot actually function anymore on human terms. And I warn you that the third stage archonic infection is being achieved through the Archonic technology which the Archons have cleverly tricked us into providing for them. Isn't this beautiful? I mean, the logic of it is so poetic. Touch screen technology is the means and vehicle of the third stage AI. Do not touch the screen, whatever you do. Now, I've given you the ideological profile, and also the neurological profile, and that's a glimpse of how I will treat the archontic infection. And when I speak in TL9 or NL9 about Islam, I will go into some more detail along these lines. But I'd like to point out that if you read the text for this newsletter and go to the links, you will see cases that demonstrate AI by proxy. I believe that Karen Armstrong, who was a dedicated Christian and who in the beginning of her life became a nun, therefore she has stage one AI by proxy. You see that? I believe that she is an example of a stage one proxy case, that is to say a Christian, who is now even supporting the adherence of the stage two infection. I mean, she's a bizarre, horrible, horrible creature. But for another example, a screaming example of how AI by proxy works, go and consider the encounter in this documentary, the Treblinka archaeology hoax, between the head Jewish rabbi for Poland, that's the first stage infection, the neural hack, and the archaeologist who comes to excavate Treblinka to prove that 900,000 people were murdered there. And at minute 41 in this documentary, what do you see? Well, I put it to you that you see graphic proof of the proxy behavior in the face of a stage one infection. At minute 41, the rabbi says to the archaeologist, if you find a mass grave, you have to stop, namely stop digging. Now bear in mind that the archaeologist, who's I think some Irish chick, who appears to have been chosen perhaps for her distinctly Semitic nose, came to Treblinka with the purpose of excavating it to find a mass grave to prove the claim that 900,000 people, 900,000 Jews, died there by finding their bones. And just a few tiny fragments of bone doesn't prove anything. You see her examining a few tiny fragments of bone in this documentary, and the voiceover says, in a very serious and heavy manner, and this proves that the massacre of 900,000 people happened for a few fragments of bone or teeth. You know how many teeth would be there if 900,000 people were buried there? Calculate it. The guy in the documentary does. So you see the archaeologist standing there with the rabbi who has stage one infection rebooted and says, if you find a mass grave, of course, you have to stop digging. And she passively consents, nods in agreement. Now, that behavior is called deference. She is deferential toward the Jewish rabbi. But in terms of the epidemiological explanation of this behavior, the rabbi has stage one infection, which causes him to make this demented statement. If you find the proof that we would like you to find of the claim of a Jewish genocide of 900,000 people, then you have to stop doing what it takes to expose that proof. What an insane statement. That comes out of the actual mental dementia of a man who has the neural hack, who has that mucus in his brain circuits. But look at her behavior of deference. That is evidence of the same infection in a mimetic expression. She doesn't necessarily have, I'm sure she doesn't have, the same, she's white, you know, she's Irish. She doesn't have the same neurological condition of infection, but she acts as if she does. That is the archontic infection by proxy. So anyway, this is a fascinating subject. At least I think it's incredibly fascinating. I think I've really broken through to something here. As I've said in the Red Ice interview of August, this is among the five top pieces of Gnostic intel that I have ever presented to the world. And this is raw Gnostic intel. I am developing it, exploring and verifying it as it is coming forth. But to turn away from all that nasty, negative, and gruesome stuff, I'd like to talk a little about the advantage going to truth. You might remember that at the end of the GNE, I raised a question and then answered my own question. The question was, how are we going to know, as correction proceeds, if it's really working its way through into the mainstream, if it's really impacting and affecting at the level of significant change events in the ordinary social theater of life? And I said, I advised at that time to take a simple orientation rather than to get into complicated perspectives. And the simple orientation is wherever you see events giving advantage to truth, then that is the evidence that her correction is reaching the world at large. Now, I'd like to cite two such events which has come to my attention recently. The first event concerns the topic or theme of Kali's magic moment. I dedicated a NAV briefing to this theme. I said that Kali's magic moment would be a moment when the horrific phenomenon of institutionalized pedocidic behavior, rape, molestation, and murder of children would finally be exposed and defeated. The people who are involved in that system would be taken down. And that's what I call Kali's magic moment. Now, recently, a crew member and subscriber to the newsletter sent me a link to this online article in the Mirror about policemen, retired law enforcement officers, as they're called in England, attesting to the fact, the dual fact, first, that they worked on many cases leading to the exposure of this institutionalized pedocital or pedophiliac network or networks. And second, that even though they had the dossier, the case, and they were building a convincing case that could be won to take down these networks, they were systematically opposed and their findings were impeded and their considerations and their evidence was suppressed. So the fact that these retired officers are now pooling together and discussing this among themselves, and that the news of their discussion has leaked out into the world at large, as this article explains, would, in my mind, be an indication that Kali's magic moment may be coming very soon. As you know, I've said that there are two events, I said in the GNE, that there are two events, above all others, that I consider to be indications of Sophia's correction in the sphere of ordinary, in the ordinary social theater. One is the one just described, and the second one is the breakdown and destruction and dissolution of the prevailing narrative lie on this planet. And what is that? Well, it's the Jewish Holocaust scenario. Now, a few days ago, I received this message from Genevieve, who is a newsletter subscriber, GNE member, I believe. It came in under the subject heading, Burning Film on the False Narrative. She's referring, of course, to the opening metaphor of this series of newsletters, when I compared the image of the Crab Nebula to the burning of a film. And I said that the imagination of the Aeon Sophia can burn through the narrative lie, like the light of a projector can burn through a film when the frame is frozen in front of the projector, in front of the projective bulb. Okay? I can read this wonderful article here, 3 or 4 paragraphs. It describes a woman, Frau Ursula Haverbeck, who was born in 1928. She's now 86. She's a survivor of the genocidal Allied terror bombing of Germany, the German onslaught of rape and pillage on Germany's eastern frontier, the anti-German pogroms and expulsions, and the post-war Morgenthau plan of mass starvation perpetrated against Germany, as well as the enslavement and mass murder of surrendered German soldiers engineered by Eisenhower, and, not to leave it out, the post-war cultural genocide of the German nation by the criminal victors. Now, these claims regarding what happened in World War II are all verifiable. These claims about the true fate of the German people are all supported by evidence and documentation. By contrast to the Jewish Holocaust scenario, which is not. It is really, really easy to knock down the Jewish Holocaust scenario on the basis of its lack of evidence, its physical impossibility, and equally so, equally important, by citing the use of fraudulent evidence to support it. For instance, the shrunken heads, the soap made of German fat, the lampshade made from the skin of Jews in the concentration camps. All this is a fraudulent, fabricated exercise, directed, in fact, by the head of the American propaganda, secret propaganda department at that time. So you can go and research this. There's nothing about it it's on the internet and it's all verifiable and the leads and the sources check out. So the message that I received with great joy informs us that on November 20th, 2014, Frau Haverbeck made history by laying criminal charges against the Central Council of the Jews in Germany under S-344 of the German Penal Code for false prosecutions perpetrated against innocent Germans concerning their, quote, denial of the Holocaust. The crime of false prosecution is punishable with up to 10 years imprisonment, and you can go to the website justiceforgermans.com to investigate this further. I literally jumped for joy when this news came in because of something that was happening to me that started in the course of the summer. Let me just take a moment to describe to you what this was. You know, sometimes I get ideas and they just take me over and I really become obsessed with them and I think about them all the time. Now, a lot of the time, my mind is empty. And some part of that time, I occupy my empty mind with Gnostic investigation and Gnostic contemplation. And that is generally how my mind functions. It functions in quite a non-ordinary fashion. And then there are times when it just seems that some idea comes to me out of the atmosphere, maybe out of the endopsyche around me, and starts to broadcast itself in my mind. And around June or July of this year, I got an idea. I'm not going to specify what it is because I may still act on this idea, and I'd like to do so in somewhat of a indirect fashion. But I'll just tell you what the idea was. It sort of came to me like one of those duh moments, you know, like duh, what do they call it? A head slapping, a forward slapping moment. I was, I guess, thinking about the Holocaust, lie, and how it is the prevailing lie that is of huge usefulness to certain people in extorting vast amounts of money from the German people and the world at large, in fact. And I was, you know, contemplating this lie, as I often do. Remember, I said at the end of the GNE, if this lie breaks, the whole thing will come down. It's the assurance that the whole system will come down and her correction will begin to show itself in an ascending or syntropic manner. Well, suddenly it occurred to me, after contemplating this subject for a long time, it sort of came to me like this. I thought, hey, wait a minute. Now, it is true that it has been made illegal to deny the Holocaust, in quotes, in quite a number of European countries, including Germany. Not in Spain, however. And, okay, that's a fact. And people who have challenged that Holocaust narrative have been subjected to a great deal of persecution and harm and financial, personal, physical damage and have been destroyed and thrown into jail and so forth. So there's a serious consequences of denying the Holocaust narrative. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. Okay, so in Germany, no one is allowed to say that the Holocaust didn't happen according to the official version. But what about going to court with a case of fraud against those who promote that version? That would not be exactly denying the Holocaust. It would be a simple act of mounting a lawsuit. And the purpose of the lawsuit would be to charge certain groups of people, for instance, the creators of the Holocaust Museum in Berlin or wherever it is, to charge them with fraud. Then, in that legal setting, there would be an opportunity to set up an adversarial process of proof-finding, an adversarial process that requires evidence, the same as applies to any trial. If you accuse someone of murder, there's a trial, and the two sides, the prosecution and the defense, present evidence for and against the charges. So how about taking the Holocaust story or particular advocates of the Holocaust story to court? I thought about this like in July, and I said to myself, or myself said to me, how obvious that is. What an obvious thing to do. And now here I find some months later that somebody is actually doing it. I've also said somewhere along the way in an interview, oh yeah, I think it was an interview that some people that they chose not to publish because of what I said about this very subject, I said that I want to see in my lifetime, and I'm getting on now, I want to see complete reparation for the German people. And I mean financial reparation. I mean reparation of their dignity, reparation of history, reparation of their national hero, Adolf Hitler. And I want to see this happen right now. And maybe I was using Vox City without knowing it. I don't know. How would I use Vox City? Maybe it just came out spontaneously. In any case, what I spoke of and what I wished for is taking place. And so I urge all of you to follow this development closely. So finally, I just want to close with a little remark about the new look of nous. You know, nous is that word, Greek word, meaning intelligence. And the Gnostics were not only noetic scientists and noetic artists, but they were also visionaries who understood the origin of nous. First of all, I can tell you on the grounds of shamanic investigation that everything is material, and that the material of nous is nucleic acid. So think nous, nucleic acid. And the nucleic acid carries the genetic code designed by Sophia and Thelete for the Anthropos. Now, when you look at that proposition, as it has looked so far, it seems rather esoteric and complex, doesn't it? It may seem hard to understand. Bear in mind that the Teleste were intellectual shamans. They were the pagan intellectuals, the elite of their time, and they were the elite for many, many, many generations, and over at least 6 millennia. It's hard to imagine that. But they were the intellectual elite and the avant-garde of the white Europeans and Middle Eastern people, because the Middle Eastern people were also white, just as they are today. Take Lebanese people, they're white, white-skinned. I've told you before, Iranians are white, you know? So there's these white cultures, not necessarily of the Nordic Aryan white strains, but another strain of the white ethnic groups who were capable of spectacular intellectual development. What did they do? They brought the endowment of nous to its genius level. Now today, that's pretty hard for a lot of people to grok because they're so stupid and their minds are so degenerated that they can't come up to the standard of Gnostic intellectualism. Okay, no problem. I have no problem with that. What I anticipate is that nous itself will change its expression, and it will morph itself into an expression that fits the mindset of this time and that can reach the mindset of this time. I predict that that happens in Sophia's correction. And so it would not be necessarily, to take people into the depths of Gnostic shamanic intellectuality, unless, of course, you want to join me on that little dance. And it's a dance that I love to do. But at the same time, I look forward in the coming year, as soon as possible, to demonstrate how the arcane, complex, and esoteric factor of nous becomes revealed, how it reveals itself in the perfectly obvious. That is my goal, and that is my commitment to you in the continuation of these newsletters and in their future incarnation as the noose flashes. So with that thought, at the 1 hour and 10 minute mark, I bid you farewell until the next newsletter, and I wish you all happiness, inspiration, and passion.